Today is Wednesday, September 9th, and this is International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Coming up, Australian teenagers sue the country's environment minister over climate change.
I think that it's really important that the federal environment minister is aware that she should be protecting the younger generations.
Also ahead, Afghanistan's vice president survives a roadside bomb. Plus, Disney's Mulan movie draws criticism over Chinese human rights abuses. These stories and more are next. Our top story today is in Afghanistan, where a roadside bomb in Kabul targeted First Vice President Amrullah Saleh on Wednesday morning. Saleh escaped unharmed, his spokesman said, but Reuters reports the attack killed at least 10 people. VOA's Aisha Tanzim in Islamabad, Pakistan, has more.
Afghanistan's first vice president, Amrullah Saleh, was on his way to work early Wednesday when his convoy of vehicles was hit by a roadside bomb. Many of the blast's victims were pedestrians during the morning rush hour. Saleh escaped with minor wounds and uploaded a video message soon after on his official Facebook account for his followers. He says a number of his brave bodyguards were wounded and have been shifted to hospitals. He says he and his young son, Ibad Saleh, who was with him, were not harmed. But, he says, the explosion was so strong that it melted the glass off my bulletproof vehicle and left minor wounds to my face and hand. Eyewitnesses say the explosion was in an area where shops were selling gas cylinders for cooking and heating. Some of those cylinders caught fire and caused secondary explosions. Saleh also apologized to people who lost their lives or property in the blast. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani and European Union representatives in Afghanistan condemned the attack. The EU called it a desperate act by spoilers of peace efforts. The attack comes ahead of a first round of peace negotiations between the Taliban and a team of Afghans, including government representatives. The talks, scheduled to be held in Doha, have been delayed over a Taliban request for the release of six high-profile prisoners wanted by Australia and France. Taliban officials have denied responsibility for the attack Wednesday. Saleh has been targeted multiple times before. Last year, an assault on his offices just before presidential elections killed 20 people. Aisha Tanzim, VOA News, Islamabad.
In Iraq, the top United States military commander for the Middle East said Wednesday that Washington would withdraw about 2,200 of the roughly 5,200 U.S. troops in the Middle Eastern country. For more, I spoke earlier with VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Babb.
So General Frank McKenzie, the head of U.S. Central Command, has said today that the U.S. is going to be cutting its presence, its military presence, from 5,200 troops to about 3,000 this month. He is saying that this is due to their confidence in the Iraqi security forces, and they will continue advising and assisting their Iraqi partners with the remaining 3,000 and to remove the final remnants of ISIS and to keep pursuing them and ensuring their enduring defeat. That is his goal. Of course, the concerns are going to be twofold. For the United States, the concern is going to be how do you protect those 3,000 forces, because Patriot missiles that defend from Iranian attacks, attack-ums that defend from Iranian-backed proxies, those all require troops to man. So that will be an interesting question that I will ask General McKenzie when I speak with him later today. Also, another concern is for the region. What will this do to affect regional stability?
Has the Iraqi government responded?
Well, the Iraqi government met with the U.S. government about 3 weeks ago, and this was discussed. I was told by defense officials at the time that there could have been an announcement weeks ago, but apparently they weren't quite finalized on the numbers yet. And then General McKenzie, when I spoke to him in July, had said the U.S. could do the job in Iraq to fight ISIS and to train the partners with fewer troops. So we knew that this was coming. We knew that Iraq was on board. The question was, what number was the right number? Because the Iraqi prime minister has been receiving a lot of pressure from people within Iraq to get the United States out. Some in Iraq see the U.S. presence as a problem because they see it as an internal fight between the U.S. and Iran that Iraq is being drawn into, and they don't want to be drawn into that fight.
And what about a drawdown from Afghanistan?
Well, we have heard from senior defense officials, senior administration officials today that there could be an announcement in the future on Afghanistan as soon as this week. We have heard from Secretary of Defense Mark Esper recently that the goal for the administration is to draw down to fewer than 5,000 troops in Afghanistan by November. But we've also heard from General McKenzie. When he spoke to me in July, he said while the Taliban has not attacked the U.S. or coalition forces, the violence against the Afghan forces and the Afghan people is higher than it's been quite a while. And he says that before the U.S. could reduce the presence in Afghanistan, inter-Afghan dialogues needed to start. And the U.S. would need to be confident that the Taliban would not host Islamic State, Al-Qaeda.
That was VOA's Pentagon correspondent, Carla Babb. A fire that tore through a major Greek refugee camp on the island of Lesbos has forced thousands of its occupants to flee, prompting concerns because dozens have tested positive for coronavirus. Olivia Chan of Reuters reports.
A fire that tore through a major refugee camp in Greece has forced thousands of its occupants to flee onto the island of Lesbos, even while dozens of them tested positive for coronavirus. The Greek government has put the island into a state of emergency. The Moria camp, as it's called, has likely been totally destroyed. The fire broke out just after midnight Tuesday, and the cause isn't immediately clear. Initial reports suggested fires broke out at different locations in the sprawling camp after authorities tried to isolate some individuals who'd tested positive for coronavirus. Arson has not been ruled out of the investigation. The Moria facility hosts over 12,000 people and was already massively overcrowded at more than four times its stated capacity. Lesbos has seen several protests in the past, both from locals and migrants, sometimes violent. And it's unclear where the migrants will stay now with the camp in ruins. Police were forced to release about 200 persons who were to be repatriated to their countries. Conditions at Moria had been criticized by aid groups who say it is impossible to implement social distancing and basic hygiene measures.
That was Olivia Chan of Reuters. This is VOA. Pharmaceutical company AstraZeneca has temporarily halted the clinical trial of its coronavirus vaccine after one participant became ill. The company announced the pause to the medical news site Stat News. AstraZeneca said it was a routine action taken when there is a, quote, potentially unexplained illness, end quote, in a drug trial. News reports say a British participant developed inflammation of the spinal cord. The participant is expected to recover. The vaccine, which AstraZeneca is developing with Oxford University, is in phase 3 testing. There is no indication yet that the participant's illness is linked to the vaccine. And Dr. Alexander Edwards, an immunologist at Britain's University of Reading, told VOA that pauses in trials are common. The police chief and three other top cops in Rochester, New York, stepped down late Tuesday, 1 week after the family of black man Daniel Prude released video showing him choking to death in police custody in March. Police handcuffed Prude and put a hood over his head after finding him running naked through the streets following a mental health episode. Prude's family has filed a lawsuit alleging a cover-up, and the city of Rochester has seen nightly protests. Amon Abid of protest group Free the People ROC said demonstrations will continue to press demands that the mayor resign, the city defund and demilitarize police, and for the state to pass a law barring police departments from responding to mental health crises. Russian police on Wednesday searched the Open Russia opposition group's Moscow office and the homes of seven opposition candidates running in Sunday's local elections, Reuters reports. The Open Russia group, financed by Kremlin critic Mikhail Khodorkovsky, said the raids were part of an old criminal investigation into Yukos, a defunct oil giant once owned by Khodorkovsky. Police also searched a Moscow office of the Khodorkovsky-owned media outlet MBKH. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jason Patingan in Washington. For the first time in Australia, teenagers have launched a class action lawsuit on behalf of young people around the world to stop the extension of a coal mine in the state of New South Wales. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Anxiety over global warming is driving this teenage campaign to stop the expansion of a coal mine near Gunnedah, 430 kilometres northwest of Sydney, in the state of New South Wales. The class action lawsuit asserts that Australia's Environment Minister Susan Ley has a legal duty to protect young people and should reject the proposal. The claimants are between the ages of 13 and 17. They argue that by burning coal, climate change will be made worse, harming their future. Rather than making the claim under environmental legislation, the case asserts the Australian government has a common law duty of care. The high school students filed an injunction Tuesday in Australia's federal court. The expansion has been approved by an independent planning commission, which ruled the project was in the public interest. But the final decision rests with federal authorities. The federal government hasn't commented on the lawsuit because the matter is before the courts. 16-year-old Laura Kirwan is one of the teenage plaintiffs. She told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation how she was scared about the future.
I'm really worried. Like, climate anxiety, it affects me, and I know many, many people that it affects. It's really, really scary to think about the future and not know whether we'll have a safe time. I'm involved in this case because climate change is really important and it's only getting worse. I think that it's really important that the federal environment minister is aware that she should be protecting the younger generations.
Whitehaven Coal, the resources company behind the mine expansion, has said it would bring social and economic benefits to the region, including up to 450 jobs and millions of dollars in direct capital investment. It hasn't yet commented on the lawsuit. Legal experts believe that given its complexity, the case will be tough for the high school students to win. If they do, it could have huge ramifications for other new coal mines in Australia, which is one of the world's major coal producers, selling mostly to India, China and Japan. In 2019, coal exports were worth about $50 billion. However, the Reserve Bank of Australia has previously noted that there are some uncertainties for the longer-term outlook for coal exports because of the shift to renewable energy and the pace of global economic growth. Australia relies on cheap supplies of domestic coal to generate much of its electricity and is one of the world's biggest per capita emitters of greenhouse gas pollution. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
A new documentary that follows Swedish teen climate activist Greta Thunberg's rise from a school protester to Time magazine's Person of the Year premiered at the Venice Film Festival this month. VOA's David Byrd tells us about I Am Greta.
Filmmaker Nathan Grossman first met Greta Thunberg when she was 15 and staged a school strike for climate change at Sweden's parliament. He asked to follow her for what he thought would be a three-week shoot. Grossman believed that Thunberg would be one of many activists he profiled in his film. What happened was a year-long project that included visits with heads of state, with Pope Francis at the Vatican, rallies in front of thousands of supporters, and Thunberg's speech to the UN General Assembly in New York. Grossman told the Reuters news agency that he had no idea Thunberg would have such worldwide reach.
I was also thinking, like, Jesus, like, This is like everything is going so quickly. What a weird kind of rush of train this is, in the sense that like we're standing here with the Pope, and just like 8-9 months ago she started this school strike, which I think says a lot about how her timing and also the way that she kind of expresses herself in this very kind of frank and articulate way, how that translated so well into the world.
Grossman also accompanied Thunberg when she sailed across the Atlantic in a racing sailboat to leave as small a carbon footprint as possible. The voyage took more than 2 weeks, and the filmmaker says he wanted to give audiences a glimpse of what it was like to be Greta.
Just I've tried to kind of follow them and her father in this crazy journey as much as I can. And I think the objective has always been to kind of take the camera and bring it down to her perspective, because I think we've seen a lot of her in the news media. She's been doing so many interviews. And I wanted to bring the viewer closer to, but how does it feel then to kind of go from nothing to become this this very famous climate activist.
The film had its premiere at the Venice Film Festival earlier this month in Italy. In a remote news conference, Thunberg said that she thinks that Grossman captured her well.
You did succeed in framing me as myself, and not the person that media frames me to be, but not the angry, naive child who sits in the United Nations General Assembly screaming at world leaders, because that's not the person I am. So I think he definitely made me seem like a shy, nerdy person, which is the person that I am.
One of the arguments that has often been used to slow action on climate change is that it is too expensive. Greta Thunberg said by remote that the COVID-19 crisis has shown that world leaders can work together and spend huge amounts of money if they want to.
Because this is such a crisis and we aren't able to handle two crises at the same time, then all other things have been put on hold. And that is just how no one expected anything else than that. But now, yeah, we definitely need to understand and realize the urgency of the climate crisis and treat it as a crisis, because otherwise we won't be able to achieve real change.
I Am Greta will air on Hulu in the United States beginning November 13th. I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
A global coalition of 321 civil society groups from 60 countries is calling for China to face greater scrutiny for its alleged systemic and serious human rights violations. The groups plan to demand an end to what they say is China's impunity at the UN Human Rights Council during the Council's session next week. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The group sent an open letter to the UN Secretary General and UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, raising its concerns about China's human rights record. The signatories stressed the need to address what they call rampant human rights violations across China, including in Hong Kong, Tibet, and the northwestern province of Xinjiang. China Director at Human Rights Watch, Sophie Richardson, says the sheer magnitude of the violations committed inside China and outside the country warrant a fundamental different response from the UN Human Rights Council.
It is high time the Chinese government actually had some sense that it would face consequences for doing things like continuing to arbitrarily detain a million people simply on the basis of their ethnic identity, and for a slew of other serious violations.
1 million, mainly Muslim Uyghurs, reportedly are incarcerated in so-called re-education camps in Xinjiang. In its statement, the coalition highlights China's efforts to distort the mandate of the UN Human Rights Council. It says China persecutes activists who seek redress from repression. It says the government in Beijing opposes initiatives to shine a light on its alleged serious rights violations and international crimes committed in countries around the world. The Chinese government rejects the UN's assessment of its human rights record as gross interference. Geneva Director at Human Rights Watch, John Fisher, says the UN needs to act on the growing chorus of voices calling for China to be held accountable for its rights abuses.
I think what has been striking around this appeal has been to see just so many NGOs from so many different countries not just expressing concern at China's suppression of rights within its own borders, which are serious enough and warrant scrutiny on their own terms, but also the global impact of China's contempt for human rights.
The Global Coalition is calling for a special session of the Human Rights Council to explore the range of violations by China's government. It urges the Council to establish an impartial and independent UN mechanism to closely monitor and report on China's human rights situation annually. It says the UN must insist that the government comply with its international human rights obligations. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Disney's release of Mulan, which is set in China and meant to appeal to audiences there, has provoked activists over its star's support of Hong Kong police and for being partly filmed in a region tied to allegations of abuse against Uyghur Muslims. Reuters' Soraya Ali reports.
Disney's new live-action remake of Mulan is a blockbuster movie generating a lot of buzz. But the film has also generated scrutiny, including accusations that it was partly filmed in a region where China's alleged abuses take place against Uyghur Muslims. There's also issues with Hong Kong. Its lead actress has voiced support for Hong Kong police. It's prompted Hong Kong activists such as Joshua Wong, one of the biggest leaders of its pro-democracy movement, to promote hashtags on social media like Boycott Mulan and Ban Mulan. This is a big film for Disney. It cost $200 million to produce the remake of the 1998 cartoon and was originally set to release in March. It will also be shown in cinemas in China from September 11th, an increasingly big market for Hollywood. Criticism began last year when Mulan's star, mainland-born actress Yu Yifei, expressed her support on social media for police in Hong Kong in the midst of anti-government protests. She did not respond to a request for comment. Calls for people to boycott the film returned once again this week, now over accusations on social media that some of the scenes were shot in Xinjiang, the epicenter of China's clampdown on ethnic Uyghurs and other Muslims, which has been criticized by some governments and human rights groups. Disney did not respond to a request for comment, and a spokesman for China's foreign ministry restated Beijing's denial of the existence of re-education camps in the region when asked about the online reaction. He called the facilities there vocational and educational institutions and accused anti-China forces of smearing its Xinjiang policy.
Thanks to Soraya Ali of Reuters for that report. That's it for our show today. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and the entire International Edition team, I'm Jason Patinkin in Washington. Thank you for listening. Stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great evening.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Since coming to power in 1979, the Iranian regime has been implicated in assassinations, terrorist plots, and terrorist attacks in more than 40 countries. As Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has said, the regime's brutality and amorality know no international borders. On August 21st, the annual Day of Remembrance and Tribute to the Victims of Terrorism, the U.S. Department of State, to both honor and remember such victims, sanctioned 14 Iranian human rights offenders, 13 of whom were regime officials involved in a brutal and well-planned attack in Switzerland in 1990. The 13 assassins, posing as Iranian diplomats, acted on the highest orders of their government. As in so many of the plots conducted abroad by the regime, these agents of terror pursued and murdered to silence the voice of an Iranian dissident. However, as Secretary of State Pompeo said in a statement announcing the designations, it is not only abroad where the Iranian regime uses fear and violence to control Iranian citizens. The United States also publicly sanctioned Hojatollah Khodai Suri, director of Iran's notorious Evin prison, where political prisoners are subjected to cruel and prolonged torture, including rape, beatings, and lack of medical care, and where foreigners are held hostage by the regime in order to elicit concessions from their home governments. The designations of these 14 Iranian officials for their involvement in gross human rights abuses mean that they and their immediate family members are barred entry into the United States. These actions send a message of support to the Islamic Republic of Iran's many victims worldwide that we will promote accountability for those who spread terror and violence. The United States will continue to pressure Iran to treat its own people with dignity and respect, said Secretary of State Pompeo. The United States looks forward to the day when the perpetrators of Iran's innumerable human rights violations will face true justice and hopes that these measures offer some comfort and reassurance to the families and friends of those lost to the Iranian regime's violence and oppression at home and abroad.
That was an editorial.